Here's the story so far. We need to pay closer attention to what nature does because we've changed it, as if the whole world had become one continent. And one of our guests already has experience with that. Good morning, and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. We started a provocative discussion last week about actively managing our ecosystem. Risky, overreaching, or maybe something we'll just have to face? The call's toll-free from anywhere in Alaska, 1-800-478-8255. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. The Arctic and the mountains will be refuges for species migrating from heat.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association's 10th Annual Conference and Board Meeting is May 10th and 11th in Anchorage at the Egan Center. Learn about new developments and opportunities from Alaska's business leaders. Network with Alaska Native Corporation executives and hear from the nation's top figures in Native contracting and small business. Agenda and registration at anvca.biz. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Village Corporation Association. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we are again. Given the nature of the program last week, I was kind of thinking the phone lines would already jam up, but it turns out we have some open lines. People have not called up, just dying to dispute what was asserted in our prior program. The worldwide discussion about climate change has flipped. It is more easily seen for now in other countries than the United States. In Bonn this weekend, working groups are discussing implementation of the Paris Agreement to limit carbon emissions, and the corporate sector is on board. It is not denying the climate has changed and how responsible humans are. That's beside the point. Corporations now talk about incentives, how a carbon tax would work, and negative emissions, the idea that more carbon can be sequestered than put into the atmosphere. Technical fixes. How long does biotechnology stay out of the mix? The corporate sector has moved on from disputing human-caused climate change, and it could be argued that some in the conservation and environmental community need to scramble to catch up, especially if they want to regain leadership of the discussion. And it is with that in mind that I called on our two panelists last week. Chris D. Thomas is a professor of conservation biology at the University of York and joins us from the United Kingdom by telephone. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Hi. Well, it's great to talk again.
It's good to have you back, and I know you're a busy man, and I appreciate you making the time for this discussion with people in the Arctic and subarctic, but also all over the world. Chris is author of Inheritors of the Earth, How Nature is Thriving in an Age of Extinction. And Dr. Mark Nelson was one of the eight people who locked themselves within the closed ecosystem of Biosphere 2 in Arizona and lived and breathed what that system produced for 2 years. Mark's new book is Pushing Our Limits, Insights from Biosphere 2. Mark, welcome back.
Great to be back.
I have had Mark on the program earlier, and at that time he was discussing wastewater gardens and the idea of dealing with sewage and human wastes. And there you are, and not to be indelicate about it or anything, Mark, but you were recycling everything inside of Biosphere 2. Isn't that right? I mean, everything.
Everything, yeah. I mean, that was the challenge. That was the beauty of it.
Yeah. So I want to, you know, when you say everything, I mean, some people are saying, now, wait a second. People know that it can be dangerous to deal with a human waste product. You could have pathogens. You could have heavy metals and so forth. I mean, how did you deal with that stuff?
Well, on the human sewage, it wasn't direct recycling, but we had sedimentation tanks to settle out solids, and we had constructed wetlands, which put the nutrients in our waste to productive use. Then it could have gone through a UV sterilizer. You know, there are pathogens. It's not something that you don't want to do this unless you know what you're doing. But in Biosphere 2, because we had shared all of our infectious diseases that was not an issue. We didn't use that.
You couldn't. So in other words, you just to clarify, you couldn't catch diseases from one another because you already had.
No, it's kind of an interesting sidelight. After about a year, our advisory committee said, you know, use the airlocks, you know, send out samples so, you know, you don't have to do all the laboratory analysis work inside. We can send in, you know, new scientific instruments. Then we started getting, we called it the airlock semi-flu, but they weren't screening who was taking our samples and putting in equipment. Once they screened for that, yeah, we didn't have infectious diseases. But anyway, to finish that story, then the treated wastewater went back into the irrigation supply for our farm. So the water and the remaining nutrients went back to, you know, maintain the fertility of our agriculture. So it was a very beautiful system, you know, that really closed the loop on both water and nutrients.
Yeah, in your book, Pushing Our Limits, you do have a diagram of this entire process for people that are engineering-minded, of which we have a great many in Alaska, showing the, you know, the distillation, condensation, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you were talking earlier about, you know, our technosphere running amok and not really being compatible with the biosphere. I think we need to, as we restructure that technosphere, look at how we can, you know, close these loops and retain nutrients, you know, where they do good and not harm, and also recycle if necessary.
One other thing that really struck me in the Biosphere 2 narrative was you had one of the eight of you was the guardian of the wilderness. And just to be clear, the wilderness was like what, more than half of the acreage of the entire project?
It was like three quarters, actually. We had, you know, of the, 2.5 acres of living areas, not the lung, we only had a half acre farm. So, yeah, that was equal to the size of the rainforest or the savanna or the desert or the mangrove or the ocean. And yeah, it was predominantly a wilderness area, which also, you know, we wanted to get a few lessons out there. I think humans have to be responsible, and Chris is on the side of how the biosphere itself adapts to what we are doing. But, you know, I think we need to limit human activity and, you know, really value the wilderness or, you know, the adapted to the Anthropocene wilderness that we do have.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe we need to get better words than just wilderness, because wilderness
right.
kind of was like, oh, gone wild. Some people are calling it the wild now, and there's rewilding going on, and it can be argued that we're ignoring what nature is already wanting to do in many cases and trying to stamp it out.
Well, you know, we were trying to emulate biomes, which are probably more useful than wilderness, because, you know, modern biomes, even the Amazon, is been, you know, in contact with their indigenous populations and shaped by it for, you know, millennia.
Yeah.
You know, so, and Biosphere 2, of course, was a grand experiment in, you know, creation science of making biomes from scratch. So, you know, there aren't any pristine wilderness areas pretty much in the planet.
Yeah. Chris Thomas, I think you probably would agree with about 80% of that.
Yeah, I would indeed. Lots of really interesting comments there. The thing that I would just pick up on is this wilderness thing that we were just talking about, because, of course, in the planet that we live in, Biosphere 1, our Earth, of course, even the most remote location now has been affected by humans through greenhouse gases. The carbon dioxide concentrations have changed, etc. The climate has changed. And, of course, the same is true in Biosphere 2. The gas composition within the Biosphere 2 had changed. So although there were areas that were relatively wild, they weren't completely left to get on with it, if I remember correctly. You were plucking algae off coral reefs, etc. And so the fact that humans were in the system were affecting the entire system and not simply the bits we were managing for our farmland or whatever.
Yeah, Mark, right?
You were
stomping the savannah even. You had to because you didn't have that size of livestock.
Wait a second. We were cutting the savannah grasses. We were not stomping the savannah. But, yeah, I mean, you know, since we couldn't get herds of grazing animals, Chris, you're, you know, totally right on. And I think that was also a very satisfying part of the human equation is that we wouldn't stand by and let biodiversity get, you know, strangled literally by morning glories in the rainforest or passion vines in the savannah, or, you know, we would intervene, you know, hopefully with some intelligence to, but basically in defense of biodiversity.
And Mark, would you say that nature was speaking back to you from those wilderness biomes that you were keeping as wild as you could? In other words, did wild nature have a voice in your closed environment?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, there was this kind of, oh, you guys are playing God and, you know, this is the ultimate, you know, Frankenstein kind of thing and you're going to control nature. Well, I mean, our engineers nearly had a nervous breakdown when they realized that the engineering was just the backup. They were the backup singers. The biosphere has a mind, you know, and it was, I guess, best illustrated by our desert deciding these conditions are not suitable for us to favor the really, you know, cactus succulent spectrum. It's too moist and humid, so we're going to develop into a chaparral, and we decided to let it self-organize in that direction.
Wow, self-organize. Chris, are you a fan of self-organization?
Well, I think that's interesting, you see, because that's what I see happening in the outside world that we all inhabit. So I'm all in favor as well of the being substantial. We can use the word wilderness areas or areas where direct human activities are much reduced. But we can't expect that world to remain the same as it was because we're just changing the planet in too many different ways for that to happen. But those places can still be inspiring places for us and still full of different types of wildlife. It's just that it won't be the same as it was. And that's the reality of the planet that we now live on. And we can't go into reverse gear and imagine ourselves back into some medieval dreamland that a rose-tinted past that probably actually never really existed.
And if it did, you died really young in it. Yeah. Well, you know, E.O. Wilson has written a book entitled Half Earth, and he really, really takes people like both of you to task, calling you Anthropocene apologists. And his idea is, well, we would just need to take half the Earth and let it go wild. Is that, obviously it's impractical and so forth, but at the same time, he really feels that it needs to be significant volume that's allowed to go wild. And we see in Biosphere 2 that more than half of their acreage was devoted to being wild.
Yeah, I think he's prompting me to write a new book, and I get the title just bubbling up in me right now, and I might call it Whole Earth. And that's the critical thing. It is a whole earth we're dealing with loads of humans that need to eat loads of stuff and use all sorts of other resources. And so the planet isn't going to stay the way that it was. We are going to want as large areas as we can of wilder areas. We are going to want intensive agriculture so we can simply produce enough food of high enough quality that we are all going to be well catered for. And that's the reality of it. And in the agricultural areas, we still want some wildlife. For example, pollinators are a very popular thing to talk about at the moment. And then we're going to want wilder areas that are both inspiring and cater for the species as far as possible, which can't cope with more intensive presence of humans.
Well, I think it's time to put out the telephone number again. It's 1-800-478-TALK. And the email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're talking to Chris Thomas and Mark Nelson. And we're kind of exploring active management of our ecosystem and many themes brought up by their two books. one about Biosphere 2, and one about Inheritors of the Earth, the idea that nature is thriving in an age of extinction. I'm going back to that extinction right now, Chris, because by the time you get to the end of your book, you are actually doubting that we're even in a sixth extinction.
I'm not doubting that the current rate of extinction is quite a lot higher than the historical average normal rate of extinction. Ever since humans sort of careered their way out of Africa, it's been clear that the rate of extinction, first of all of large mammals and then increasingly of a wider range of animals and plants, has been higher than the historical background. The question is whether we're in a mass extinction. And to some extent, you can just say that's semantics, because a mass extinction in the geological record is typically defined as three quarters or more of the species going extinct. And we could end up that way, but it's going to take us 5,000 to 10,000 years or so to get there. And so that's, of course, a vanishingly short period in the history of life on Earth. So if this was to continue at the current rate of extinction, and we were geologists 10 million years into the future looking back, we would call this a mass extinction then. But because we've still got thousands of years before it qualifies as a mass extinction, we as the human species do have a lot of opportunities to make sure that it doesn't translate into one of these sort of geological epoch-defining mass extinctions. And that's what we really need to make sure doesn't happen. But meanwhile, the weird thing is that there's new species coming into extinction as well. And coming into existence as well. So new hybrid species, for example, like Italian sparrows, like a kind of ragwort plant that only lives in York. There are new species coming into existence as well. And once we start looking at the long time scales, we have to appreciate that they are a process, if you like, for the re-diversification of life on a human-modified planet. Nature didn't just give up when humans came along and said, oh, no, I'm just going to go extinct, that's it. The survivors continue to survive, grow in numbers, diversify, whatever hits the planet. So it's going to be it already is a very different place. It's going to be a very different place. But we have to decide for each change that we see, is it by definition a bad change because change is taking place, or are we prepared to go with some of these changes and accept them? And if we go back to the wilderness idea, if it's different, first of all, are we capable of? And secondly, do we really want to micromanage the wilderness areas across our planet to try and keep them a special way that we want them? Or do we let nature effectively rip and heal itself, you could say?
So I suppose one could even argue that you're arguing for a wilder wilderness than the wilderness managers are.
Yeah, that's right. I'm just saying hands off to some extent, there's... You know, the atmosphere has... Take carbon dioxide, for example, in the atmosphere. Obviously, that is the building block that's used during photosynthesis by virtually every plant on the planet. Those carbon dioxide concentrations are already higher than they've been for millions of years on the planet. This is an extraordinary thing. And that means they have affected the growth, more or less, of every individual plant on the planet already. And some plants do better because of those concentrations are higher, and some don't do quite so well. Well, they would all do better if it wasn't for the competition with other plants, probably. And so we have this situation that we have changed the growth of all of the plant life because the carbon dioxide concentrations have changed. The ratio of carbon to nitrogen in our plants have changed as well. And that affects every animal that eats them. So this is just like, we can't undo all of this and think, well, if I if I shoot some predators, if I cut my meadow in this way, I'm going to go back to some world that existed previously. It's simply not on the cards. We don't have it in our power to do it, at least not for, we might get there where we're scrubbing CO2 out of the atmosphere in the future, but at the moment we just don't have it in our capacity to unchange the world back to something that might have existed a few centuries or a few millennia ago.
Well, let's flip 25 years back to the Biosphere 2 and Mark Nelson. You had a tremendous CO2 problem there, and you did use scrubbers a bit, but then you basically put all hands on deck. You put growing things anywhere there was going to be light any part of the day, and you generally... Can you tell through your measurements whether what Chris is talking about is realistic? In other words, that there is increased photosynthesis, so there is increased growth, so there is increased sequestration, and you guys ended up like, what, filling your lungs, literally, with biomass.
Yeah. Chris raises some... really intriguing points there, and I have to say, Chris, I find your book and the point of view you're both advocating and studying really a wonderfully neglected part of it. The biosphere does adapt. I do think in terms of responsibility we need to work sort of both sides of it, one appreciating the capabilities of biospheric organisms to adapt. They always have, but we do have a responsibility to steward our actions. I think it was actually one of the other biospherians who pointed out that it's megalomania, as you were kind of implying, that we can be stewards or micromanage the entire Earth. That's prodigious. All we can do is really captive breed, make little manipulations here and there, and I think many of them, certainly reintroducing condors and the like, are pretty they're pretty cool actions. But we need to calling humans potentially stewards of nature, I think, is megalomania. What we need to be stewards of is our behavior, including how we farm and how we manufacture and our expectations of our life and how we can achieve that, minimizing these unintended impacts on the rest of the biosphere.
Yeah, when I read both books together, Mark, you really make it a point to delve into these issues. In other words, you say, okay, here's our agriculture. Here's the world's agriculture and food production. Now let's look at what we did. We ate a quarter pound of meat per week. A quarter pound of meat per week, and some...
quarter pound per person per week.
Yes. Yes, but some didn't. Some didn't eat any.
Well, yeah, by the end of the 2 years, I think 3 or 4 months before the end, if you don't have a lot of meat in your diet... I guess the digestive enzymes that you need, start to falter, and then you get some real... That was one of our major problems, is overeating at feasts and people getting intestinal gas, from meat that they were no longer digesting.
Properly. I don't even want to think about that in a closed environment there. I was thinking about the permafrost and all the methane emissions, and you guys and your livestock, too.
Yeah, I think the cows get a really bum rap. Of course, a little prejudiced because one of the ecotecting projects is a cattle station in the Kimberley. But, I find it the height of irresponsibility to, blame, compost heaps and cows for, the sum total of human actions.
That's just plain funny, Mark.
Yeah.
You're killing me. Joe joins the program from Petersburg. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Joe.
Yeah, hi. I've been enjoying the conversation that the English fellow and the other one. I'm sorry I didn't catch your name.
He was a guy from New York, Mark,
right,
yeah.
Some blokes.
The blokes.
Oh, yeah. I feel like this program's missing the point. Where I feel like the house is on fire and we're standing back, observing the fire and kind of discussing how it caught on fire, but we're not talking about how to put the fire out. And I was thinking, in World War II, the United States government was focused solely on winning the war. Everything changed. If a factory built cars, it now built guns. Women went to work to replace the men. Agriculture was directed. This is what we needed to do. But now our federal government has pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords, and the whole federal government more or less denies man's role in creating global warming, kind of like a flat earth society. And we're just kind of floundering in the wake of the deniers and everything else. We can't seem to make any coordinated forward progress to deal with the problem. On one hand, trees are our best friends in soaking up carbon. Here in Alaska, we're busy cutting them down as fast as we can and sending them out on log ships in the round. On the other side of that equation, the oceans are absorbing the other part of the carbon, and they're more than 30% acidic now, and we just kind of have trouble stopping that equation. Alaska has the whole, from almost top to bottom, all coastal communities are a great number that are almost totally dependent on the oceans and seafood and fisheries and everything else. And that's all starting to get a little sketchy itself. And then throw in the more severe storms and rainstorms. And you see what I mean? The house is on fire. How can we start getting a coordinated effort to knock this fire down a little and allow life to continue in the future without, burning the house to the ground?
Joe, do you want to stay on? I'm going to take it on first. I'm going to pass it to the panelists. But and what I'm going to say is that that's what they're doing in Bonn right now. These are the technical committees that figure this stuff out. How are we actually going to implement this agreement that we have in Paris? When you speak of a political situation in the United States and what kind of idiot news media stuff is going around, fake news and non-fake news and somewhat fake news and so forth, I'm sorry, maybe what I'm trying to look at here is something that goes beyond this very short-term political situation. I think right now we have to limit our expectations of our political leaders in the United States. But then you see, like in China and other places, well, they're looking further ahead, and so is the corporate sector now. So there comes to some point where we just have to say, okay, we'll just write these guys off and wait until they go away and get busy doing the stuff we know needs to be done. We need to know where our agenda is when we actually get back to work on it here in the United States. And the rest of the world, they're actually already working on it. Joe?
Yeah, that could be. I'd like to hear the response of your two guests.
Okay, please. Do you want to hang up? We'll take our break and then we'll bring them back in. Is that okay?
I'll stand by.
Oh, you'll stand by? Great. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. 4 out of 5 Alaskans addicted to heroin started by using prescription opioids. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents anyone from taking them without permission, which could endanger them and lead to consequences with law enforcement. Find out more at opioids.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Public media is about you, the community we serve. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be right back.
It's Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel, and we have a return engagement with the authors of two remarkable books about active engagement with the ecosystem. We have Joe on the line from Petersburg, and he says, wait a second, there's a whole lot of denial, and we're all standing around watching the building burn. Well, I'm saying that's in the United States. Other places are starting to move. And let's take the perspective from the United Kingdom first. And Chris Thomas, how would you respond to Joe here?
Well, I think Joe's, you know, hit one of the nails on the head. And I would generally say that we should put much more of our effort into addressing the fundamental causes of the changes that are going on the planet, and a little bit less effort, although we still need to put quite a bit of effort, into patching up the consequences afterwards. Now, specifically in the context of climate change, the real problem here is that there's so much economic, business, and cultural turnaround, and this stuff does take decades to do. But it is going in the right direction. So in Britain, there's just been a news item today saying that Britain, coal, of course, is the fuel which is very efficient fuel, but it generates the most carbon dioxide per unit energy that you get. And we've, in Britain, have just gone 3 days straight without using any coal in our energy supply.
Bravo. Yeah.
So that's the first thing. I mean, some of the replacements are not that green. There's no, I'm not going to congratulate ourselves at all. There's lots of bad things still happening. But things are moving in the right direction, but it's a bit at a time. And then the other thing I would say is that much, of course, as I like to annoy Americans at every opportunity, actually there's a lot of Americans in the scientific community, the business community, right through American society, who are fighting very strongly to make this stuff happen as well. And you probably saw in the news in the last day or two that a pledge by Michael Bloomberg, the former mayor of New York City, who's going to pay $4.5 million to help support the it's not to replace the funding that the US would have put into fighting greenhouse gas emissions as a whole, but to help support the global United Nations Climate Change Secretariat, so that the global process in this direction isn't faltering. So I right going back into the 1990s when there was a lot of disbelief of the climate change thing in the US, it was still American scientists who were coming up with a lot of the evidence and the explanations as to what was happening, why it was happening. And so actually America has made huge contributions to the global progress on this, even though, at least in the short term, it has what I might call a little local difficulty.
Joe?
If I remember correctly, the tropical storm that took out Houston last year and more or less wiped the place out, flooded it with 50 inches of water and just everything else, cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 to $9 billion of economic damage. These storms, I would guess, are going to continue, and they're going to get stronger. And I think eventually, after maybe another dozen of them throughout the next dozen years come ashore of our coasts and elsewhere in the world, governments will start to get really serious about trying to take
real measures. People are really serious.
Stop the decline of the climate and the changes that are taking place, but. I know Alaska's melting, the permafrost, and it's already Alaska's kind of on the front line of the climate change issue.
Oh, yeah, we got storm surges hitting into Nome now. Yeah, Yeah, it is true.
And it
Joe.
Isn't just governments, it's insurance companies
yes.
are really putting the pressure on because they're really taking big hits and they are very unhappy and they're really pressurizing business and governments to take action.
And
have you guys got any ideas of what individuals can do to spur their local governments on and try to get more action out of our representatives in Washington, D.C.? That would be something that I think local people could sink their teeth into and maybe even create some action as a result of this show. So thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show. Hope to hear another call or two, and enjoy your perspective very much, both speakers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank
and
you.
It's always, it's great to get the perspective of fishermen. I don't know if Joe's still fishing, but generally speaking, they're very, very weather conscious in Petersburg. And I know because I have attended a number of scientific symposia on climate related things that. Sacramento right now is a storm surge disaster just waiting to happen. I mean, it's already taken New York City, Houston, Texas, Biloxi, Mississippi, and New Orleans. I mean, taken. You know, flooding the subways in New York.
Puerto Rico.
And oh, my God, I'm so glad you brought that up. Here you guys, the Institute has a reforestation program going in Puerto Rico, and suddenly all their trees aren't there anymore, and they're out there salvaging the old trees. What a transformation that is.
I just got an email from the manager of that project, and they're doing great work of saving the hardwoods that the hurricane brought down all over the island. But if you have a couple of listeners who are resourceful and want to volunteer in Puerto Rico, she's sending me an SOS today to put out the call through my institute, so I'll take a moment of the radio show to pass that on.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Our telephone number here is 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And Mark Nelson, a former biospherian, is with us, biosphere 2-ian. I don't know what you call it here. But, Mark, you're with the Institute of Ecotechnics. You're in touch with all their other projects in other parts of the world. I've visited a couple of affiliated projects down in South America. I was very impressed. And in both cases, these are situations where private individuals and community organizations are just simply taking it upon themselves to declare large conservation units and let wild nature have its voice and pay attention to it. It was quite inspirational to me. And tons of this.
Like Chris was saying, I mean, you know, we tend to focus on bad news and the media kind of promulgates that. But, you know, there are a ton of people who are working at the grassroots level making a difference. And I just wanted to say I totally understand the urgency that Joe is expressing. You know, the house is burning. You know, it is a really dangerous time that we are in. You know, in my concluding chapter of that book, I say, you know, we're basically facing a human species IQ test. And, you know, the biosphere will continue to live. Whether human civilization will continue is really an open question at this point. And in the book, you know, so the perspective I got in Biosphere 2 is kind of invaluable because we were working like hell to, you know, keep our world healthy. And it wasn't even altruism, it was self-interest. If our biosphere got unhealthy, if we had pollution, we would be the recipients of it. That's totally the case in our global biosphere. So part of that book was the meditation inspired by my experience in there, is how have we lost as modern people, you know, certainly the pagans, Native Americans, indigenous people around the world, they were connected to their biosphere. They treated it as something sacred. They understood, you know, that they were not separate from it. And I think, you know, when Joe's asking about what can people do, I think the first thing is we really need to rekindle that, you know, understanding, that deep understanding that we're part of the biosphere. And I think then we will start to take action. We'll be motivated because, you know, attack on the biosphere, a degradation of the biosphere. It's a degradation of us and our lives.
Yeah, Chris, I take it you would echo that because it's pretty much the last line in both of your books.
Yes, I was just sort of contemplating, though, the idea. So clearly we need to think about the responsibility of our actions and keeping the global system going, because we now, with transport of food, goods, people all around the world, the atmosphere mixing across the planet, everything that goes into the oceans ending up in big swirling areas and so on, we're living in a connected world. So we have to think of it as a system with us in it and be very careful about the future. I might perhaps dispute one thing that sort of Mark was implying about some, less technical societies and their perspectives. I would point out that the early low technical societies of humans, as they wandered their way across Asia into Australia, then down through North and then into South America, they wiped out systematically virtually all of the largest mammals.
Hey, man, that's a lot of meat, man. What are you?
Yeah, it's a lot of meat. It's great, but I'm just saying that one should be very careful. Well, I agree completely that different societies have different ways of looking at things, and that's really important lessons for us right now all over the world. I'm also thinking, though, one should be very careful not to sort of imagine some noble savage living in harmony with nature, because it's clear that the noble savages, including my own personal ancestors, made an awful lot of mess of big animals in the past. And we're still living with the consequences of that.
I'm really enjoying this conversation, Chris, because over in the United Kingdom, we've gotten down to pub hours, and you've kind of gotten into the pub attitude, I gotta say. Mark knows what we're talking
that's
about.
That's me on a good day.
Our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. And in Anchorage, John joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Hi, I was just wanting to say that these are interesting academic discussions, but the reality of it is, the planet Earth has a fixed finite amount of carbon that's present in the biosphere, and that carbon can only be utilized by transferring from one set of organisms to another. And in the case of the human population, it's a staggering number, and it's going to become even larger. And I think the problem is that the political and economic systems that we have now cannot possibly handle the results of this. In addition to that, we have a cultural differences, which one of your speakers just mentioned, and the religious differences, which result in huge surges in population with no hope of understanding the relationship between those consumption of resources and the impact on the planet. And a lot of that has to also do with common ignorance, because the world population really is woefully undereducated and have no idea about these relationships. So at this point, I'll leave it for you to discuss it. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, John. I've had this similar argument with Mark, actually, and I even notice in the book that you basically modified your population concerns in between your draft and the way it was finally printed. I'll start with you, Mark.
It got more poetic. No, your caller brings up a really important point. And I do think that, you know, part of the nub of the problem is both our technology and the crudeness of the solutions that were originally chosen, and the fact that we've got, you know, 7 billion and rapidly increasing. The demographic transition that I know I bring up a few times in the book is kind of important, because one is, you know, just wagging your finger about these issues doesn't really work. And, you know, a great deal of data supports that increased standards of living decrease the number of children that people have. And the single, you know, most important vector is empowerment of women, education of women, to where they make those choices. So I think, you know, the future is not doomed to be an endless, obviously exponential expansion. I mean, limits to growth pointed that out 50 years ago. you know, is impossible in a finite system.
Yeah. Chris, before I ask for your input on that population issue, I think we'll take our little break as Talk of Alaska continues.
Today's program is underwritten in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Money is generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
Chris Thomas in the United Kingdom. I think I'm going to co-opt that question about population here and steer it just a little different, because essentially your book, Inheritors of the Earth, very specifically makes the point that the human alteration of the landscape of the Earth is huge. The amount of arable land that's been converted to crops that then feed livestock and so forth, the alteration is already enormous. And it's obvious that human carrying capacity, well, I mean, it's that is a judgment call. And we're dealing with time dimension. Human beings' generations is 20 years. And we are dealing with these cultural factors that Mark touched on a little bit, that the minute you start empowering women, you actually start knocking down the birth rate. The minute people have a better standard of living, you also are knocking down the birth rate. And this is well established over and over again. So we have all that. And your book is even a broader sweep than that, because you go to the idea of when the continents were together and how the creatures evolved when the continents pulled apart, what happened when North and South America joined together, a very, very dramatic narrative of how what species from the South ended up in the North, with much of the northern species going extinct. And then it went the other direction as well. A colossal narrative in this book, Inheritors of the Earth. And now we have this human creature that in a very short period of time geologically has taken over the planet and clearly has multiplied to enormous, vast numbers that it has huge impact, and you wouldn't dispute it. The question is, what do we do now?
Yeah, it certainly is. And, it's, you know, just to reiterate that, as far as we know in the history of life on Earth, no animal or plant has ever transformed the world at quite the current rate of change over such a large extent of the entire planet's surface. There have been major biological revolutions, many of them, of course, in the past, but we clearly represent as a clothed ape, we represent the biggest perturbation for a very long time. So how do we deal with this? Well, you know, picking up on the population thing, that actually it's pretty good news, because the population birth rate is dropping off in pretty much all parts of the world. And a lot of the projected growth, most of the projected growth for the remaining, for the next, say, 50 years, is actually because so much of the world population is young at the moment, particularly in Africa. And as they grow older, they will breed, they will have children, grandchildren, and so on. And that's actually going to account for an awful lot of the growth, rather than because the birth rate continues to be out of control. So good news, and I agree completely that making people wealthy and healthy and secure as well is the great way to do this. I love the statistic that, although it's not the case any longer because of immigration across the Mediterranean, but for many decades, Italy had the lowest birth rate, actually rivaling Sweden, in Europe, despite the fact it was in principle the most Catholic country in Europe, and birth control was forbidden. But it was the culture of being well off, having empowerment to make decisions that reduce the birth rate. But we're still going to have to deal with more or less 1.5 times the current world. Do I mean that? Yeah, 1.5 times the current world population, roughly, in 50 years' time compared to what we've got now, or getting on that way. So we're going to need more food. And this is, to some extent, where I have a bit of concern with the E.O. Wilson-type argument that, okay, just leave half of it. But it's not the reality, because we've got these people. They're going to have more people, and they're going to need resources. And so what we need to do is to intensify our farming systems across the world so that we can produce any extra food. We've got to reduce the waste and increase recycling so that we can feed and keep people at a good standard of living, which we all want, and in an equitable world we would all have, but maintaining as much wildlife as we possibly can at the same time. So it's really about the efficiency. From now on in, I see it as being about the efficiency of the use of the planet, yeah, rather than any perception that we can go back to something we had before.
Yeah, and we're also seeing a lot of cultural and demographic change, as you just sort of touched on a little bit there. Mark, do you want to one other thought here, and then I want to get a little bit more big picture?
I think Chris made some wonderful points there, and I cite in the book, because it was so wonderful to discover it, a major UN report talked about the solution about expanding food availability and all of that ecological intensification, rather than, you know, plowing up more land and doing more conventional agriculture. And a lot of these shifts are happening. I mean, I think probably anyone who knows a substantial number of young people, and Chris, you as a professor must see it. I'm just astonished at how many people are turning vegan and vegetarian. And there's another issue that we don't have time for, which is the climate debt that we, you know, it's incumbent on the, you know, more prosperous countries to put some resources to help the, you know, the poorer, less developed countries do it in a more sustainable, not follow the dirty and nasty path that the West followed.
Yeah. Well, all right. I did want to put each of you in your inspirational spot here for a moment, and I'm going to go to Mark first, because Mark, yours I think is somewhere down there inside of Biosphere 2 in the early 1990s, and you realize you are responsible for everything. I don't know if it's a godlike feeling or what it is, but there you are, your feet in the water, the pipes all around you, and you get a feeling.
Yeah, I mean, and I think Chris was alluding to that. We have this feeling in the big world, the big biosphere, that our actions don't count. In Biosphere 2, you know, it was so tightly connected and everything moved, cycled hundreds of thousand times faster that, one, you knew that you were part of it, and there were no small actions. There were no anonymous actions in Biosphere 2. And, you know, when I was getting ready to leave, I went around and hugged trees that had grown from little saplings of 30 and 40 foot ones. I also hugged the cement pillars that wound up, you know, absorbing a lot of our CO2. Of course, our oxygen went as well. But, you know, I had this really profound knowledge of the interconnection of everything in Biosphere 2, not just to the humans and the soils and the plants and the microbes and the animals, but every bit of technology, you know, is part of and intimately connected.
And, Chris, I want to take you to your thinking meadow. I mean, you actually got some acreage up there in York, and you go out there and think, and there came a point where you asked yourself a question about how fast evolution actually happens. And I think you're getting some answers on that now.
Yeah. So it's sort of a multi-step thing. There's never quite that moment but I'm really lucky to have 5.5 acres of land next to an old former farmhouse, and everything in that landscape is derived from humans over generations and generations transforming the landscape. And I've just happened to come along in the last 15, 20 years and add my little bit at the end. And when I start counting the butterflies, I find that, you know, we've got about 25 species or so in the garden, but there's only about 60 that are breeding species of butterfly in Britain, because it's a rather cold, wet island. And so more or less we're getting on for about, we're sort of more than a third of all of the British butterflies I've got in my little meadow. And then a similar thing for birds and for mammals and so on. And I realized that I've got in my garden, for the groups of animals and plants that I've looked at, somewhere between about a quarter and a third, sometimes more, of all of the British species. And they're there in the garden because of what humans have done, not in spite of it. So all of these species were already adjusted to humans. And then in less attractive surroundings, walking down the stairs of my office in York, I suddenly realized, you know, with all these new hybrid species coming into existence, all these species evolving adaptations to the human world, maybe as many species, again, new species are going to come into existence because of us as die out. And that was almost a transitional moment, because the moment you've asked the question, what's the rate at which new species are coming into existence? Is it because of us? And to what extent can they replace what we currently have? You suddenly think of humans as transforming the world, but it's not 100% negative. There's negatives, but there are also positives. We want to try and reduce the rate at which the negatives are happening, but we can also think about how we can promote positive change in the biological world, and that's just as legitimate a thing to do.
Mike from Copper Center, you got 30 seconds.
Okay, sir. Thank you for having this conversation. I really appreciate it. And I'm living here in the boreal forest in Peace, rural Alaska. And what I try to do or would like information on is how I can personally, reuse rather than recycle, and what kind don't eat beef, those few little things. So if you have any information on that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, well, keep sequestering as much as you can, I think, is one of the big ones there. Yeah. And we run out of time here. I really want to thank our guest, Chris Thomas. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, he's the author of Inheritors of the Earth, How Nature is Thriving in an Age of Extinction. Mark Nelson, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you to Deborah Snyder. In Santa Fe, Wesley Early, Dave Waldman.
Is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Join Alaska Public Media TV every week for Think Wednesday, featuring a dynamic lineup of programs exploring the thrilling world of nature, technology, and science. Think Wednesday explores the mysteries of our world and our universe, bringing the most exciting and inspiring stories that provide the answers that curious minds crave. Think Wednesday, every Wednesday beginning at 7 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This program is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. This is Alaska Public Media.